You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach. Going to be talking American League East here. I'll be checking in shortly with all five MLB.com AL East beat reporters. It's a division that I don't think anybody could have seen going this way. You've got four teams in pretty close bunching with each other, and then one way out in front of them. The Orioles are threatening to run away with this division, while the Yankees, Blue Jays, and Rays try to fight in the wild card race, and the Red Sox try to look at what goes on next year. We're talking the Baltimore Orioles with MLB.com's Orioles beat reporter, Brittany Giroli. The big news, aside from the standings this week with the Orioles, is Ubaldo Jimenez. Move to the bullpen. Is this a short-term move just to sort of buy some time, or is this something that's going to be maybe this way for the rest of the year?
Well, I think at this point, Matthew, you're looking at the rest of the year. I mean, there's no real short-term. You've got about 2 weeks until roster expansion, which really is what the Orioles are trying to get to. Once they get to September, they've got extra guys up here. They don't have to worry about where Ubaldo fits in. They can kind of bury him. So where you are in the season, I think it's too late to say, hey, maybe you can pitch for us and start for us again. You're in mid-August right now. The Orioles are trying to win the division. They've got a nice, comfortable lead. And they feel like their best rotation right now does not include Ubaldo Jimenez.
You mentioned the lead. Is there any notion, and apparently not because the decision's made, but is there any idea that maybe they are in a position where they could give him a few more starts to get right, or is this just sort of the end of somebody's patience?
It felt like that, which is why he got that start over the weekend. He hasn't really done anything to deserve or warrant getting starts over a guy like Miguel Gonzalez, who they sent down to clear a roster spot. He's pitched to a 3.80 ERA in 20 games, 19 starts for the Orioles. You got Ubaldo, whose ERA is up over 4. So already giving him starts was trying to get him right. And I know it didn't go over well in that clubhouse when they sent Gonzalez out. I talked to a couple guys as recently as yesterday about what they were going to do with him, and everyone understands it was a $50 million commitment. You've got to try and get him right. They feel like they've given him enough of a chance. Whenever he's in the game, he does lead the league in walks despite missing a month. So it really changes the dynamic of the game, not just on the field with the guys behind him who kind of just sit there and watch him walk guy after guy, but I think it just changed the mentality as well. And it's no surprise that they've only lost one series in their last 10, and that's been in Cleveland when Ubaldo Jimenez pitched. So I think, like you said, they're done giving him chances. They feel like they've given him a long enough leash. He's had really this whole season to prove he can get on a roll. I think they'd prefer to just start fresh next year.
So if you look at Jimenez's career in the last several years, 4.68 ERA in 2011, 5.40 in 2012, 3.30 last year, 4.83 this year. Did they just get this wrong? Was last year the outlier, and is this just the guy he is?
Maybe. And I think they hope not, but he hasn't really had an excellent track record. They went out and they did what everybody wanted them to do. They got a free agent starter, and now it looks like they might have been saddled with really a mistake for the next 3 years after this. So I don't know. I don't think anybody knows at this point in time. They're hoping that's not true, but he really hasn't established a consistent track record of success up here.
What does this mean going forward? Again, when you talk about the contract, this guy's signed for 3 more years. He'd be an awfully expensive mop-up reliever. I mean, is this something they revisit in the winter? Does he come in the next year presumably as a starter? I mean, I know I'm sure that's not what the manager's thinking, but it's got to be somewhere in the front office's thought process of this is a significant investment. How do they kind of recoup some value from it?
Yeah, I think they're thinking that to some extent, although on the other hand, Peter Angelos is the kind of guy who would just say, hey, you want to cut bait? Let's cut bait. I think people don't realize how much ownership is invested in winning now and how much faith they have in the job that Buck Showalter and Dan Duquette have done. So I think he returns this spring as the starter, and they take it from there. I don't think they have any expectations going in that it's going to be any different than this year, but they're just going to wait and see. For now, he's not part of their immediate plans. They're trying to win the World Series.
Is it as simple as not throwing strikes, or is there more to it as to why he hasn't been better?
Well, I think he's had trouble throwing strikes his whole career, Matthew. Yeah. When you look at his delivery, it's unorthodox. He's got average stuff, but he's got so much deception because he has so many moving parts. Now, the issue is, because he has so much deception and so many moving parts, he can't repeat that delivery. And Mickey Callaway, for some reason in Cleveland last year, really got to him. Things really clicked in the second half, and he was able to consistently put it together. But basically, that's been it. He hasn't been able to show any of that. He's shown flashes of dominance with the Orioles, but it's always been within a terrible start. There's been a couple innings, even in Cleveland, where he settled down and then couldn't hold it together again. So it becomes an issue of consistently repeating his delivery. It becomes his mechanics, and it's been something we've talked about basically since this spring with him. So it's no big secret what needs to be done, but the issue is that's what makes him successful in the first place.
Right. So while we're mining unpleasant topics, what's the status of Manny Machado? They didn't make a lot of news about how long he was going to be out or what's going on. What's his status?
It's been very veiled. We don't know what ligament is. We don't know what grade the sprain is. So basically we're dealing with whatever information the club gives us. Now, he is on the road with the team. He was in Cleveland this weekend. He's in Chicago now, doing some baseball stuff, trying to strengthen that area so that this doesn't happen again. But honestly, I don't have a timeline on him. I asked Buck over the weekend when he was going to start baseball activities. Buck wasn't sure. So a lot of it's just wait and see. But I think the expectation is he's going to be a guy that they add in September under roster expansion. So there's no big rush because they've proven that they can win without him. I think they want to get him right so that they have him for the postseason.
Is he declining to say what's going on? Has he been told not to say? Does he not know? I mean, it just seems like a really weird situation there.
It is a weird situation. He has declined to say. Buck alleges that he doesn't know what the grade the sprain is, which I find very hard to believe, given the nature of how much Buck is on top of everything, how meticulous he is. So I think it's a case of they just figure the less the media and the public knows, the better. When Manny comes back, great. They don't want to put a timetable on it. They were tired of him dealing with this all spring, obviously with the other knee, but the question kept becoming, is he having a setback? Will he make opening day? I think they want to take all of that pressure off him, which is why we don't have any information.
Now for some good news. You had a piece this week about a single big game, but Nick Markakis has really had a bounce back year. How big a part of what's going on is he to this club?
I like to say that he's kind of the heartbeat of this club. And people that watch the Orioles once in a while don't really get to appreciate it, but when you're in that clubhouse, when you see him play every day, injured all the time, these guys are so beat up right now, there's just a litany of things going on with Nick Markakis, as there are other guys in there, but he is just incredible to watch. He takes pride in being in that lineup every day. He's a quiet leader. He's someone that the younger guys turn to and look at and say, all right, well, he doesn't look fazed, he doesn't look ruffled, so we don't need to be either. That catch the other night when he went and jumped and basically over the fence and robbed Connor Gillespie of the home run that would have changed the game, certainly. It's a perfect example of Nick Markakis. He gets up, shows that he has the ball, immediately runs head down into the dugout. He doesn't like to be the spotlight of anything, but he can't help it this year. He's having an incredible year for them. He's really been healthy, I think, for the first time in a long time. He was able to have a regular off season where he was lifting and getting stronger. I know he did yoga and Pilates and has really been focused on trying to make sure that his body holds up over the course of a season. He's had some unfortunate injuries. The Orioles are still angry about CeCe Sabathia hitting him with a pitch, ruining his season in 2012. So keep in mind, he hasn't been part of a postseason. He wasn't there in 2012. He was injured. So to Nick Markakis, this might be his last shot to win, especially with the Orioles. His contract is up. He has a very expensive option next year. So this is a big year for him, and he's certainly stepped up.
Was it as simple as the offseason trouble and sort of trying to get healthy last year? Because he really had, from the outside, a concerning year last year. When a guy has a year like that, he's not old, but a guy who's got a lot of miles in his body has a year like that, it's a little worrisome. Was it just a matter of health last year?
Yeah, I talked to him extensively this spring, and ever since we saw him really take his first couple at bats, he's looked like a different guy. And I think people don't realize he had 3 surgeries in a calendar year. That takes a toll. He was never able to lift or get stronger or do anything that he liked to do in the winter to really prepare. And that's what he was able to do this spring. He showed up about 15, 20 pounds heavier, just really looked solid and strong and ready to go. And I think it was as simple as that, as getting healthy and having the time to devote to getting his body ready for this grind.
All right. Well, Brittany Giroli from MLB.com, thanks for taking some time to chat Orioles here on MLB.com Extras. We're talking Toronto Blue Jays with MLB.com's Blue Jays beat reporter, Gregor Chisholm. Gregor, I continue to have no read on this team. They get their guys back, they score 16 runs over the weekend, and suddenly they can't prevent runs anymore, and they go 1-2 against the White Sox. What is this team, really, now that we're 5 months into the season?
Yeah, it's one that I think everyone, even in that clubhouse, has had a hard time figuring out. It's really, they've had a really hard time putting everything together at the same time. It seems like when the offense is going, then the pitching staff goes through a long period of struggles. When the pitching staff is going, then the lineup has really kind of struggled. And you really look at there's been 3 points in this season that have kind of dictated where they sit in the standings right now. And there's a three city road trips that they've had. There was one just before the All-Star break when they went 2-8, which was very costly on the West Coast. Then immediately after the All-Star break, you know, they had another three city road trip where they started off 6-1 through Boston and New York. It was a major, major step forward. And then they finished that with three losses in Houston, which was just kind of really a devastating blow to that road trip. And then the road trip that they're just coming off now. You know, it's been a big-time struggle for this team lately, and they're kind of reeling right now to try and figure things out.
We're three-quarters of the way through the season, and they're fourth in runs scored and 11th in runs allowed. For a lot of the middle of the year, the narrative was the offense is the problem, the pitching is fine. Is that kind of a red herring?
Yeah, it's, you know, a lot of the offense couldn't be stopped in May and June, and you know, and you kind of look at the production that they've had. You know, the numbers do compare favorably to the rest of the league, but you know, the problem is they've gone through these really long stretches where they just haven't been able to get any production. It's been the overall consistency. The team doesn't really know what to expect from one week to the next. Where the pitching staff has, for the most part, you know, they've kept them in a lot of the games. I don't think anyone was really expecting this pitching staff to carry this team by any means. It was supposed to be the offense all along. And so the pitching did enough, but now I think you're starting to see that kind of unravel a little bit with some guys who are probably pitching a little bit over their heads, and a guy like Jay Happ, who is coming back down to earth a little bit in his last couple starts after really going through a stretch of about a month where he was a really strong pitcher. And then you have kind of the ups and downs that you have to expect from young pitchers like Marcus Stroman and Drew Hutchison, who are still kind of learning what it takes to be successful at this level. You have to expect that there's going to be some ups and downs with those guys, and I think overall we're starting to see that unpredictability of the rotation kind of starting to shine through.
And you lead me into the next thing I was going to ask. I mean, you don't want to overreact, but when a guy like Stroman, who is approaching stuff he's never done before, has two out of three rough starts, is there a level of concern about that?
I think there has to be. A little bit, at least, you know, especially when you're talking about the overall workload. As you said, he's really kind of entering territory that he's never been in before, and so he's going to have to be someone that's monitored. I mean, now the three starts ago, he had a very, very poor outing and then bounced back with a great start. So it's going to be interesting to see where he goes from here after struggling in his last outing. But you absolutely have to kind of keep a close eye on him, and I think, you know, ultimately where the Blue Jays are in the standings in the coming weeks is probably going to decide what direction they go in with some of their young starters. You know, if this team happened to fall out of the race completely, then you're probably looking at giving a little bit of a rest to Hutchison and Stroman instead of really kind of pushing the limits on their overall innings. Now, if the Jays think that they can still make a run, that's obviously not going to happen. They kind of need all hands on deck. But if this team does continue to fall in the standings a little bit, I wouldn't be surprised if at some point in September they give those guys a bit of a breather for the rest of the season, either shut them down or potentially move them into kind of a bullpen role where they can manage their innings a little bit.
The flip side of that is that, you know, one thing you feel like you can always count on from Mark Burley is innings. He's always been a guy who piles up innings, even if he's not putting up great numbers, he gets deep into games. Last seven starts, he's gone 33 innings. How big a problem is that when the one guy that, or one of the two guys that you count on to get deep into games isn't getting deep into games?
It's big, and you know, he's in danger of not hitting that 200 inning threshold that seems to have been, you know, the expectation for him every single year. And you know, he talked about it a little bit after his last start, and he was understanding of a quick hook that John Gibbons had for him because he realized that he had struggled a lot recently. But he was kind of stating that he hopes that this organization still trusts him to be able to eat up those innings. You know, it was Gibbons came to get him in the sixth inning of his return in Chicago. He was pitching relatively well up until that point. But the track record for success that Burley's had over the last month didn't really buy him the type of leniency that he's used to having throughout his career. And, you know, as he says it, he's getting older. The fastball, which was never really that fast to begin with, continues to dip a little bit, and he realizes that there's a lot of wear and tear in that body. He's just hoping to be able to give him that opportunity to continue eating those innings because he feels healthy, but the results haven't always been there to get him that extra workload.
Ultimately, they don't really have much of a choice but to ride him, do they? I mean, if the kids are questionable, to some degree, don't they have to kind of ride him as many innings as they can?
Yeah, absolutely. And R.A. Dickey would fall into the same category. I mean, those are guys who aren't going anywhere. They're going to be on the mound every fifth day, and you really kind of rely on them to be your innings eaters. And you know, you know, those are the guys that you kind of look towards, especially with the amount of workload that the bullpen has had to go through because of these short outings that they've had occasionally from Stroman, from Hutchison. The bullpen's had this situation where it seems like every two or three days they're having to go six, seven innings, which is just it's crushing their long relief. And then not only that, but then they have to go through a lot of their middle relievers as well. That obviously won't be a problem come September 1st when you get some extra hands on deck. But right now, those veteran guys, you're right. I mean, those are the ones that they have to kind of rely on when the bullpen is tired, especially to eat up as many innings as they possibly can.
Okay, so we've spent all this time talking about what's wrong. How does this team get back to where the expectations are? How does this team get really into the mix of fighting for a playoff spot?
Well, the optimism can be found. I mean, the one thing Gibbons likes to talk about, you know, this week has been the fact that they do have Edwin Encarnacion and Adam Lind back in the lineup, and typically it's going to take a little while for those guys to get their timing back, to get into the flow of things again. But it makes that lineup look an awful lot better than it did before. It finally looks kind of like a more stable lineup. You don't have Deanna Navarro hitting cleanup anymore. You can go with your top four or five guys and have that same lineup that was really dominating, you know, back in May. You know, so I think they have to rely on the fact that those guys are back and that they can continue some of the production that they had earlier on this year. I mean, Edwin Encarnacion in particular is a guy who can be a major difference maker. He's someone who can carry a lineup for stretches of time when he gets hot. He did have a home run in Chicago, so there were some early returns there. But overall, just his presence, what it does to you know, force teams to pitch to Jose Bautista. And, you know, sometimes we can overstate that a little bit. But in this particular case, I mean, Jose Bautista just wasn't getting any pitches to hit for really upwards of three, 4 weeks during Encarnacion's absence. Opposing teams just didn't have any motivation to pitch. And we were seeing situations where, you know, it extended even beyond that. There was, you know, a series in Detroit where they intentionally walked both Melky Cabrera and Jose Bautista to load the bases to get to Juan Francisco with two outs. I mean, that's just something you can't do when Edwin Encarnacion's in the lineup. So you really kind of have to, if you're the Blue Jays, you really have to hope that they don't take too long to really get into the swing of things because time is running out for that team. But when you look at the talent in that lineup is still there.
The other thing that might work to their favor here is that after a couple of weeks of tough schedule, it doesn't get easy, but they don't really see any of the AL's top teams for nearly a month now. Rays, Red Sox, a decent Yankees club. Rays, Red Sox, Cubs, Rays. Is this an opportunity for them to get back into it?
Yeah, definitely, especially when you look at the schedules that the other teams that are competing for that second wild card have, their schedule compares quite favorably to what those other teams have. You know, the Rays do typically play the Blue Jays very, very tough, especially when the Blue Jays go to Tampa Bay. That's kind of a house of horrors for that organization. But, you know, for the most part, you know, especially there are some teams that you can take advantage of there. I mean, the Red Sox are a team that the Blue Jays have played pretty well this season overall, especially of late. And so there is an opportunity there to make some room. And as you talked about, I mean, there's a lot of the fact that they've gone through their toughest road schedule as well is big. I mean, this team over the last month and a little bit has really had multiple tough road trips, three-city road trips that go through multiple time zones. And, you know, that's not an excuse. No one in that clubhouse will use it as an excuse. But the fact is the upcoming schedule is a little bit more favorable. They have a lot of home games coming up. They don't have those long road trips like they had before. So if there's reason to be optimistic, that's another cause for that as well.
Gregor Chisholm, thanks for taking a few minutes to talk with us here on MLB.com Extras, talking a little New York Yankees with MLB.com's Yankees beat reporter Brian Hoke. Brian, a week or so ago, there was, I don't want to overstate it, certainly not a dust-up, but a couple of different views of the Yankees' status. And you heard, well, wild card, and you heard, well, division. Is it safe to say at this point the wild card is the target?
I think at this point, yeah, you have to say that. And I think going to Baltimore and losing two of those games, obviously it was a rain-shortened series, but after that second one, Sean Kelly was one of the people in the clubhouse who said, well, you know, I think at this point the wild card's a little bit more realistic goal. And, you know, I think it's the Yankees, so you never want to say they're out of the division race, but you look at the standings, and I think you understand where Sean Kelly was coming from, and you hear that from a few people in that clubhouse that, look, the goal is to get into the playoffs. If they can get a better seeding, that's fantastic. But at this point, given the way things have been going, I think just getting in the tournament would be a good goal.
It's a weird combination of things because the results the last week or so have not been what they wanted, but they've gotten some good news. You get Pineda back, you get McCann back. It seems like maybe there are some reasons for optimism even as the results are turning. I mean, where just kind of overall, where do you see this club as being at right now?
I think that's fair to say. There's some things to be very encouraged about. I think that the fact that they're going to have Pineda back and making starts. I mean, look, this guy's made 5 starts in 3 years for them. If they can get him healthy down the stretch in September, I think that's huge, not just for this year, but also for next year, because you're not really 100% sure what you're going to have in that rotation for next year. So I think that's a big get. It's fantastic that Brian McCann was able to come back so quickly. I mean, you're always worry about concussions a little bit. You never know how a guy is going to react to that. Last year, the Yankees had Austin Romine, and he had a concussion, and we didn't see him again. That was it. He was done for the year. They were talking about him coming back the first week of September, and he never came back. So the fact that McCann's coming back and having no ill effects is huge for that team. So I think that there are reasons to be encouraged. Look, there are problems with the team, absolutely. They're still not scoring runs the way you would like. Last night, you look at David Robertson and gives up the big three-run homer to Chris Carter. But it really should never have gotten to that point. You know, the Yankees have to beat up on the teams that they're supposed to beat, and the Houston Astros certainly fall in that category. And when you don't do that, it just creates a little bit more of an uphill climb for you.
It's been somewhat quiet and somewhat gradual, but if you look back over 7-8 weeks, Brian McCann has been pretty close to what I think you can expect from him. Do you think that he's kind of sorted out after that first 2 months or so?
Yeah, absolutely. I think he's been a different player since the All-Star break in particular, and probably you can trace it back a week or two before that. I think that for whatever reason in July, something started to click. And, you know, he's been a different guy around the clubhouse too. He certainly wasn't having a whole lot of fun the first 3 months of the year. You know, hitting .210 had something to do with that, I'm sure. You'd like to see a little more power. I would have thought that the short right field porch at Yankee Stadium, you'd be talking about him as a 25, maybe even a 30 home run guy. Clearly, he's not going to get there this year. But I think that the fact that if you look at his month of July, he hit over 300. That was a pretty good month. He obviously got slowed by the concussion. Now you wait and see if he can come back and keep swinging the bat well. But, yeah, he's been much closer to the kind of guy that the Yankees thought they were getting when they spent all that money on him. And, you know, I think that's a good sign. If maybe you can chalk that up and say, sometimes guys just have trouble adjusting to New York. It's a lot different from the situation he was in Atlanta. Maybe it was just a little too much, too soon, too quickly. Maybe he wasn't completely prepared for it. But for whatever reason, something seems to have clicked. And, yeah, he looks more like the player that they gave $85 million to.
And that was what I was going to ask. I mean, I'm the last soft factors guy in the world. I tend to just tell me performance. But it is kind of natural to wonder if there's just some element of guy leaves the only organization he's ever been in, goes to an organization where the expectations are even higher than the high ones where he came from, has a contract to justify him. And do you think that there's some element of it being as simple as that's a really tough adjustment even for a decorated star major league player?
Yeah, I mean, and consider this too. When he's with the Braves, I mean, that's his backyard. He grew up there. There's a comfort zone. You know, you can get in the car and in 15 minutes you can be at his childhood home. So leaving from Turner Field. So I think that coming to New York City, obviously you don't have to live in Midtown Manhattan to get a feel for the area and commute to Yankee Stadium, but it's just a different animal. It really is. You go in the clubhouse and there's 20 or 30 reporters there instead of two or three, and they all want to know why you're not hitting and why you're not living up to the contract, and hey, you're 0 for 10, and what's going on? And so I think that there's certainly more attention. There's more noise that you need to learn to block out. You know, I can't claim to have ever played in New York, but just sensing the difference, some guys make the transition better than others. And I think for McCann, it probably was a little bit more than he thought it was going to be. And, you know, but I think that if he can continue hitting, it answers a lot of those questions.
Don't sell yourself short. You played on the field at Yankee Stadium, at least.
Not very well, though.
Well, you know, that's not necessarily a problem. Let's go to the topic that is tired and nobody wants to talk about, but Derek Jeter, since the beginning of July, has a .289 on base and a .295 slugging. Now, I know you can pick any selective endpoints you want, but does there ever come a point, and I know the answer to this, but I still have to ask it, does there ever come a point where competitive considerations for some kind of change in any way as to how he's used down the stretch?
You know, it's funny. Joe Girardi said this year he wasn't hired to manage a farewell tour. That's the one thing he didn't want to do. But kind of circumstances are what they are, and particularly if the team is not in contention down the stretch. But right now they're fighting for their playoff existence. And I think you saw something down in St. Pete when they played the Rays, and Girardi used Jeter twice as a DH. And I think that's, A, yes, I agree that the turf can beat up a guy, especially a 40-year-old shortstop who hasn't played a full season in a year. You know, you give that guy a break whenever you can. But, B, they have better defensive infield there when you have Stephen Drew at short, and Martin Prado played terrific at second base. I think that, you know, I was talking to Mark Teixeira, and I said, did you know this guy was that good at second base? And he said, well, I played with him in Atlanta. So, yeah, you know, I think that that might have been a little bit undersold. I think that defensive infield is much better, and that's no slight on Jeter. I mean, hey, he's 40. He's coming off a year where he didn't play at all. He's going to be their everyday shortstop. But I think that if Girardi has the option to DH Jeter a few more times or give him a break down the stretch, I mean, I know the fans aren't going to like it if he's not in the lineup, but I think that for the purposes of winning games, I think it's something they're going to definitely look at. So there may be some fatigue going on here. As I've mentioned, he missed all of last year. I mean, limited to 17 games. You see a lot of these ground balls, weak ground balls, the third base, the shortstop. It's kind of increased, and you mentioned the numbers that you did. I think that if you can give Derek a little time and let him recharge a bit, maybe he'll be all the better for that final sprint to the finish line.
Is that a matter of a guy cheating? It seems like that's a lot of times what you'll see when a guy maybe doesn't have the speed anymore. He starts to cheat to hit the fastball and ends up rolling over, breaking balls to pull him.
Yeah, I mean, there's been numbers that show that Derek has been getting gassed by fastballs, you know, and it's not just the guys who throw 95-plus. he's been having a little bit of trouble to catch up to the 92, 93 big league fastballs. But here's the thing about Derek Jeter. The second that you start piling on and count him out and say, well, see, here it is. He can't do it anymore. People have been saying that. People have been burying this guy for 5 or 6 years now. So he still can do that inside-out swing to right field and get on base and come up with a key hit to win a game. You know, he was in a situation down at the Trop where he was trying to move the runner over. He was trying to bunt 4 times against Jake McGee. Couldn't get it down. Wound up hitting the ground ball to second base, got passes into the outfield, and wound up winning them the game. So the second you start saying, well, see, this is it, he can't do it anymore, he finds a way to surprise you.
You mentioned the defense, and whether Jeter's in there or not, this seems like a pretty significantly upgraded infield defense. Now that you've been watching it for a couple of weeks now, how much better are they in nearly any configuration, depending on what they do at second with Headley at third and just kind of the pieces they have there?
I tell you what, watching them up close, I think that Headley has been a huge upgrade defensively over what they had in Solarte and Kelly Johnson earlier this year. You know, the shortstop situation, I don't think we've seen enough of Stephen Drew. I mean, certainly you can look at his track record and you know what he is and you know what Brendan Ryan is. But Jeter's a shortstop. I mean, that's just ironclad. It is what it is. At second base, I think that Drew has made the transition a lot better than I expected. There haven't been too many plays where he's looked like a fish out of water. And, you know, I think that's impressive considering it's kind of just learning on the fly. He had never played an inning at second base as a professional before this year, and they dropped him in there and said, all right, you're the starting second baseman for the Yankees. I think Prado can still do it. It's funny. It's almost like their best second baseman happens to be their right fielder. So I think that Prado is a good option there. And, you know, I think that the infield defense, and Teixeira has looked better too. He had a shaky start to the year, and he's kind of smoothed that out. I think the infield defense is certainly better than it was in April and May. You know, I think that's incremental upgrades, as we've talked about before. I think that if you can do that, and obviously it'll help the pitching staff, you know, save runs wherever you can because they're certainly not scoring a lot of them.
Brian Hope, thanks for taking some time to chat Yankees here on MLB.com Extras, talking the Tampa Bay Rays with our MLB.com beat reporter, Bill Chastain. Bill, it's been kind of a long slog for the Rays at times, but they seem to be having some good news here. It seems like Will Myers' return is imminent. What do you expect from him when he comes back?
You know what? I mean, it could go, you know, a lot of different ways. I mean, he's been away a while. You know, it could be a little bit rusty. You never know. But on the hopeful side, you know, he might give them that big bopper they've been missing in the lineup for so long. They just really have had very little production offensively since he went out this year. And actually, he really wasn't producing that much when he went out. He had a bad left hand at that point before he hurt his right hand. So I think it could, you know, give them a little bit of a boost. And, you know, there's still a bunch of teams in front of them in the wild card. But, you know, we've seen with this team before that strange things tend to happen with this team.
Yeah, that's for sure. You know, they may have miscalculated on some things, and if you ask them, they'd probably say they might ought to have added another bat over the winter. But I mean, guys who should hit on this team have not hit. And it starts with Longoria, but you know, Escobar, Desmond Jennings. There are some guys you expect to hit have not been as good as you'd think they would be. Why do you think that is?
You know, it's tough to figure out. I know we were talking last night about, you know, I thought – Longoria is about as close to money in the bank as it gets. You know, as long as he's healthy, you know, you think you're going to get what you expect from him, and it just hadn't happened. And I know we talked to him at length about it, and, you know, he says, I hold myself to higher standard than anybody, and I can't figure it out. I work, you know, I'm working as hard as I can, but it's just one of those things where it just hadn't happened. On the bright side on that, if you're an optimist, you know, he usually has one period, you know, one or two periods a year where he's just crazy hot. And, you know, if that's coming, that would bode well for the Rays. And who knows, that he might get a little kick start if Myers comes back to give him a little help in the lineup. So, but it is, that one is the one that really is the head scratcher for me. The other ones, you know, I mean, kind of up and down guys anyway, but Longoria is the main guy.
The flip side, Kiermaier has been an absolute revelation Has he played himself into some long-term plans for this club?
Good question, because you know his offense has started to kind of trickle down a little bit, and sometimes I think they feel like he's playing out of control. You don't want to rein him in too much because you love that energy he brings. But just like last night, the play where Kinsler hit the ball that he dove for, and it's the first batter in the 11th, and it turns into a triple. Joe Maddon said he wasn't mad with him because he says, I thought he could have caught that ball. Now, if you're just diving to dive, that's another matter. But I still think there's a little bit yet to prove on his offense before you pencil him in long-term there, even though I love his energy and I know the Rays love his energy.
Still, with that said, it seems like there are plenty of other guys that there are questions to be answered on the offense, too. I mean, really, even Desmond Jennings, you can't help wondering what he's going to be offensively.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, you look at what they did on their outfield picture coming into the season, and you had Jennings, Joyce, and then they re-signed DeJesus to, a two-year deal, basically. And that was the one I was a little bit surprised on, just based on how they do things, giving the outfielder of his status that kind of money they did when you had Joyce sitting there and Jennings. But I think some of that was based on the inconsistent performances of Joyce and Jennings. And so, they're kind of left to kind of figure out which of these guys, to hook their wagon to for the long term. And it's going to be interesting to see. And, you can also throw Brandon Guyer in there. He's been a nice surprise for him.
And as it turns out, DeJesus has actually had a very nice year. He's getting on base and been one of the things that has gone right for them.
Yeah, but of course he's been out, since the first part of June. So it's tough being a GM, I think.
I guess it's constant evaluation, but as the front office looks at a club and tries to get into October, and we've talked about this at the clubhouse before, but from the front office perspective, how much of what's going on right now is figuring out what they have and trying to sort of start figuring out the 2015 roster?
Well, a big part of what Andrew Friedman will tell you any time is that, part of the hardest part of his job is figuring out if what he's seen is going to be long-term performance or if it's just something that's, an aberration for this year. And it's very, it's apparently very difficult to ascertain which of the two it is. Do you give up on certain guys because they, didn't have a good stretch run this year and try to go get someone else, or do you try it out again next year? I know I heard one thing where they felt like the results that they were getting were about, because they simulate these games, they simulate seasons, and the results they were getting were about a 5% chance of what they thought would happen or what their results told them would happen. So, but which guys do you hook your wagon to next year based on, this year's results? So it can be confusing, I know, for the GM and the whole front office in evaluating these guys.
So when you have that outlier season, what do you do about it as a front office, as a decision-making team? Do you just say, well, those things happen and stick to the plan, or do they adjust some things about how they go about their business?
Well, the way they do things, I'm sure they look at their model and see if it needs to be tweaked a little bit. And then they have to go about their business of, talking to their scouts and seeing what's out there. And then, their scouts who are looking at their own guys and figuring out, which guys, are for real and aren't. And again, that's where it, becomes a crapshoot sometimes. And I think that's where they, the really good ones earn their money, is figuring out, evaluating which ones are the good ones and which aren't.
One piece of good news, and they might not consider it a surprise, but certainly at least meeting expectations, has been Jake Odorizzi. How good is he for real? I mean, he's been dominant since about early June. Is this a guy that maybe is becoming a front-of-the-rotation starter?
I don't know about front of rotation, but certainly towards the middle. And, the big thing watching him that I've been surprised at, and, the more I've learned about it, kind of amazed, is how many swings and misses he gets. But, they credit a lot of that to he's kind of deceptive the way he delivers it, so the ball gets on you a little more quicker than the speed is looking. And then also he's effective pitching high as well. So he's got more zones in which he can, you know, put pitches in, and that kind of puts the hitter in a bad way. You know, it's like having extra pitches if that same fastball's high and low, inside, outside. And but he just seems to gain more confidence, and he really seems to have that kind of mental toughness that he could, you know, be, you know, middle to high part of the rotation. So, you know, that Royals trade is still looking great for both teams.
I got to think they're pretty happy about it, even with the challenge of this year. Are there any more? And I ask you this last week. I ask you again next week. Are there any more moves to be made by this club before August 31st? Do you think?
You know, based on the way things have been going lately, I think the only moves you might see is if, you know, they traded one of their players. And, you know, I don't know which ones have cleared waivers. Of course, that's, you know, the information you never know. I know I asked Andrew Friedman yesterday, and he was kind of coy with me. He said some of them have, some of them have cleared and some of them hadn't. And, you know, for those who aren't familiar with that, that's basically you're just making your players liquid. You know, you're becoming liquid where you can trade your players at this time of year if you want to. But, you know, that's the only thing. I don't see them going out to get somebody to make a run, but I could see them being tempted to trade somebody if, you know, it was the right deal and, you know, it unloaded some salary and they got some prospects or some close players who were close to ready type guys.
All right, well, Bill Chastain, thanks for dropping in here at MLB.com Extras. Getting ready to talk some Boston Red Sox with MLB.com's Red Sox beat reporter, Ian Brown. The big news with your club this week comes in center field. Jackie Bradley Jr. is down. Mookie Betts is up. What do they want to see from Bradley? There's not a lot of time left in the AAA season, not a lot of time for him to go get right. What do they want him to accomplish at Pawtucket over the next couple of weeks?
To tell you the truth, Matthew, I think that they wanted to get a message across to him that, you know, they wanted him to work on some real fundamental things with his hitting approach, and that's basically shortening his swing is a big point of contention. I don't think that I think they might have thought he was being a little too stubborn, to tell you the truth, and I think that they think that, you know, maybe this would be a wake-up call that, hey, you know, you don't know everything. You know, we're teaching you these things for a reason, so I think it was kind of a firm message. And I also think that a little caught in between Jackie Bradley Jr. and Mookie Betts right now. They're trying to figure out, you know, which one of these guys really is their center fielder of the future. And personally, I think they probably waited a little too long to send Bradley down because, you know, this guy has been slumping basically all season. He had one nice little stretch before the All-Star break where he hit about .345 for about a 30-game span. But aside from that, this guy's been slumping all year. And now it's August, so they want to see Mookie Betts play against competition in August because, look, there's an old adage in baseball that you can only learn so much in September when you're facing teams with expanded rosters. It's a little harder to evaluate. So I think as much as sending Bradley down, they want to get a look at Betts right now and see if they have a better idea what they have from him, both offensively and defensively, you know, going into next year.
So not to be too blunt or unkind to a guy who's already having a bad week, but how long do you have to hit .215 for before you realize that maybe you do need to listen to coaching and change your approach a little bit?
Yeah, no, it's been very interesting. I've had quite a few talks with Jackie myself, and what the team says to me about him and what Jackie says, it's kind of different a lot. You know, where Jackie says, oh, you know, I don't really need to change anything mechanically. It's just I just need to feel comfortable. And then John Farrell was talking about very specific things that they were trying to get him to do. And I almost think Jackie feels like, you know, they were trying to pull him in too many different directions rather than just let him hit the way he's hit his whole life. So I think it's been kind of a difficult path at times between the team and Jackie. And, you know, any slumping hitter, you do hear from a lot of different people, you know, on what he should do. And maybe Jackie just feels like he has too many voices and he's not thinking clearly up there. But, you know, look, no doubt this guy can field, gold glove fielder, but, you know, you can't carry a .215 average, you know, for a contending team.
The thing that stands out to me about Bradley, and you watch him every day, he had a really good strike zone in the minors. He got on base and didn't strike out excessively. He struck out some, but And that's just completely turned on its ear in the majors. I mean, he's struck out in nearly 30% of his plate appearances. He doesn't even walk every 10, 11 plate appearances. I mean, it's a real bottoming out of a guy who had a good strike zone. What happened there?
Yeah, I think he still has a pretty good batting eye, but what's happening with Jackie Bradley is he's missing so many pitches. He's swinging and missing so often that, you know, pitches that he used to foul off to extend at bats and maybe ultimately work a walk, he's just missing those pitches. And that's, you know, it all goes back to this thing that we're talking about shortening up that stroke, because his swing to them is too long. You know, I can see a little bit where Jackie's coming from. Look, Dustin Pedroia has always had a long swing, and people thought that he was going to have to shorten that up, and for whatever reason, that swing has always worked for him. So I think Jackie still thinks it can work for him, too, and it's just not coming out. I still do think he has a pretty good eye, though. I just, like I said, when you swing and miss at so many pitches, you're not going to be able to keep at bats alive long enough to walk.
The flip side of that is the guy who's coming in, Mookie Betts, is a pretty well-regarded prospect, but I don't think he is as highly rated as Bradley was coming through the system. What's the read on what Betts can be, not so much this year, but kind of in the longer term?
Yeah, Betts is pretty exciting because of his you know, his raw athleticism. And he's just a kind of an exciting guy to watch. Better speed than Bradley. The one thing, you're right, you didn't hear about as much as him because he was, you know, he just kind of stuck up on people. You know, he was a high school kid who really came through the system fast. I think that, to be frank, they expected he would be a couple years away from now, but he really, he pushed through the system so fast. And, you know, that versatility, you know, it's almost like it's been great, but it's also been a bit of a drawback because they're not quite sure, you know, what, you know, is this guy our center fielder? You know, second base obviously isn't going to be an option because they have Dustin Pedroia for a long time. Can he play another position? So it's just, you know, he made that transition from the infield to the outfield this year, and I think they're still figuring out what kind of outfielder he can be. But they think with his athleticism, you know, once he gets enough reps in the outfield, they think he has all the skills to be a really good outfielder. Maybe not as good as Bradley, but a really good outfielder defensively.
Is there some configuration that includes both these guys as significant parts of a near-future Red Sox team?
Yeah, right now it's kind of hard for me to see that one because, look, you have, you know, Xander Bogaerts is going to be your shortstop. You know, you're going to have, Dustin Pedroia at second base for a long time, and now you've added Cespedes, and you've added Alan Craig to the outfield. And you know, you don't know, what are you going to get from Victorino next year? Are you going to get anything from him, or are you going to have to trade him? So, you know, I don't see a scenario for Betts and Bradley, and I think that's why they're doing this, because I think before the season ends, they want to have a clear read on, look, which one of these guys should we go with, Bradley or Betts? And I think that the other one, it wouldn't surprise me at all if the other one was packaged in a trade this winter.
So you mentioned this a couple minutes ago, but given all that, and given that it seems if they do, in fact, have to make a decision, and it hasn't, it's not like they were their position in the race just changed in the last week. Why wasn't
right.
this done sooner?
That's a great question. And, you know, I asked it the other day. Didn't get a clear answer. I just think that they were caught in between on this. And Bradley's defense had been so good for a while, and they just wanted to give him every chance to come around, and it just didn't happen. I think that, you know, to be honest, I think they waited a little too long. And like I said, kind of get caught in between.
Let's talk about something other than center field so we don't take up 10 minutes on one topic. It sounds like things are coming along a little bit for Alan Craig. Is his return pretty imminent, it seems?
Yeah, Alan Craig, you know, he'll be back by the end of this week. And this foot injury that he has, that the first day he got to the team, he was, striving to reach first base, and he sprained the foot a little bit. And there were red flags just because of the, you know, we all know about the serious foot injury he had last year and how much it impacted him. In hindsight, the Red Sox admit they might have been a little too conservative on this one, and probably for good reason. Look, they just acquired the guy the day before he got the injury, so they didn't want to, you know, they thought, you know, I think sometimes there's a temptation for the guy just joins the team to say, hey, I'm going to play through this. I think they took it out of his hands, made sure he didn't do that, let him slow it down, let him get a second opinion. The second opinion was exactly what they wanted. So now they're excited to be able to get a pretty good look at this guy the last 2 weeks of the season to see if he can get some of that offensive group back. Because, look, this guy can be a really good hitter. I know you watched him play quite a bit for a long time. He could be a pretty good hitter. And he didn't show it this year, but I think they think it's still in there, and they'd like to see that before the end of the year. Because, you know, like we were talking about with the center field situation, they need to know you know, where they stand on a lot of these situations before they go into the offseason and really attack their offseason plan when it comes to making trades and signing free agents.
You mentioned I saw Craig a lot. I need you to help me out. I need you to take over ownership of the hashtag the wrench. That's important with Craig, so please, you know, that's important. The possibility for him to kind of maybe build a little momentum going into the winter, do you think that's a big deal for him to have a strong 5 or 6 weeks and go into the offseason feeling good about where he's at?
Yeah, I really do. I think if Alan Craig can just, look, become comfortable here in Boston with his new teammate, with his new teammates, with his new environment, and just put some good at-bats together. I think that this park could be really good for him. Fenway is really good for a lot of guys. Not that he's a dead pole hitter, but this park is good for just about anybody to hit in, I think, when they're feeling good. No foul territory, and keep at-bats alive. And he's going to be around a bunch of pretty good hitters here with Pedroia and Cespedes and Ortiz. So, yeah, I do think that it's important for him psychologically to get some confidence before the end of the season and for the team as well to know what they have going into next year.
Yeah, I do think you need to be worried about him and Cespedes hitting line drive singles off the wall, but I guess that's a consequence you deal with. Ian Brown, thanks for taking a few minutes to join us here on MLB.com Extras, and thanks, everybody, for listening.